From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, our holiday series continues with more of our favorite interviews from 2017.
My name is Hasan Minhaj, or as I'll be known in a few weeks, number 830287.
That's comic and Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj performing at this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner, talking about being a Muslim American and the son of Indian immigrants in President Trump's America. He describes growing up different from other kids and different from his immigrant father, who didn't approve of the things Hasan wanted to do, like listen to hip-hop, watch cable TV, and have some fun.
His rules with me growing up were very simple. No fun, no friends, no girlfriends. You can have fun in med school, which is just like a huge lie.
Also, we hear the onstage interview Terry recorded in June with Seth Meyers, host of Late Night. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we continue with our holiday week series collecting some of our favorite interviews of the year. In a while, we'll hear from Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj. But first, we'll start with Seth Meyers, host of NBC's Late Night Show and former co-host of Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. Terry interviewed him in front of a live audience in June 2017. This year, Fresh Air celebrated its 30th anniversary as a daily show on NPR, and this live event was part of that celebration.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank all of you for coming this evening. You know, it's sometimes hard to sleep at night, and the political chaos isn't making it any easier. The old joke about late-night comedy shows is that they put you to sleep. The way I see it, late-night comedy, like Seth Meyers' show, makes it safe to sleep by helping us laugh at the issues that otherwise would be keeping us awake. Was I a little annoyed when he started to cross over into my territory and do interviews? Nope. I like his interviews. I became his fan when he started co-anchoring Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live back in 2006. After Tina Fey started her series 30 Rock, and by leaving, she did him a big favor because he took over both her jobs. He became the head writer and co-anchor with Amy Poehler of Weekend Update. And of course, he returned the favor by later writing hilarious sketches for Tina Fey when she was playing Sarah Palin during the 2008 presidential campaign. So to get started, let's watch Seth Meyers' opening monologue on Late Night from Monday of this week after returning from a week off. Here we go.
President Trump last week announced that he was pulling the country out of the Paris Climate Agreement. We're pulling out. So now our climate policy is the same as Mike Pence's birth control policy. White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said today that President Trump will not block former FBI Director James Comey from testifying before Congress. That's a good call, because if you block the testimony of the FBI director you praised for investigating Hillary Clinton and then fired for investigating your ties to Russia and then lied about why you fired him and later admitted why you fired him, you might look guilty. White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said today that President Trump doesn't care what you call his proposed travel ban. Okay, racist.
Please welcome Seth Meyers.
Thank you, everybody.
It's so great to have you here. Thank you for
doing
this.
I am so honored to be here.
Oh, it's so great to have you. So, you thought probably when you were leaving Saturday Night Live and Weekend Update that you'd be taking a step away from political comedy, and you did for a bit.
Yeah.
And now you're deep back in.
Yeah.
With your opening monologue and then a closer look in which you focus on a political subject, and it's usually Trump.
It has been Trump for a while now, yes.
So comedy is going places that it's political comedy is going places it's never gone before. I don't know if you've made jokes about Ivanka and Donald Trump, but people have been making kind of incest jokes.
Sure.
And then you've done jokes about him being cold to Melania and not caring about his son, Eric. And you gave him the finger on TV the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the fake press conference where you were asking the questions and you cut in his answers, and all of your questions were about his penis, because when he talked about his hands, that seemed to open the door to his penis. Yes, so it...
I'm so happy how quickly we have gotten to this, Terry.
I did not want to waste any time.
Everybody said, you know, Terry in person's a lot saucier.
So late night comedy has changed. There's like an unprecedented president opened up the door to unprecedented comedy.
Sure. Well, when the standard of what a president says drops so low, it seems
when he
silly.
Goes low, you go low.
Right. Exactly. And I, you know, I always want to stress this because I think a lot of us that do shows like we do, that I do. My many colleagues who are really good at this too, people say, oh, you're doing the job of journalists. I think it's very important to note that we can't do our job without journalists. Journalists can do their job without late night comedians. They'd be just fine without us. But we, of course, use their work every day to build our pieces. But I do think that comedians have this advantage that journalists don't have right now because, thankfully, and I think we're all lucky as a society that journalists are trying to hold this standard and hold this line of what it means to be a journalist and the integrity that it means to be a journalist, whereas comedians are built for the Donald Trump era because we comedians notoriously have very low levels of integrity.
Okay, so since we've been talking a little bit about humor, about Donald Trump, I think it's only fair that we watch the 2004 sketch that you did with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
In 2004, Donald Trump was the guest host, and there was a sketch called Fathers and Sons, and as you'll see, Donald Trump was the father, Seth Meyers was the son.
This is so eerie and weird that this is a thing.
Okay, let's roll the tape.
Hi, welcome to Fathers and Sons, the show that teaches and discusses how positive communication between fathers and sons can make this special relationship between two men even better. I'm Peter Fleck, and this is my dad, Gary. There's no reason why sensitivity and warmth can't be key ingredients between fathers and sons. That's why we're here today on Fathers and Sons. Isn't that right, Dad?
You could really cut that intro in half. Boy, it's way, way too long.
Okay, here we go again. All right. It's a bit long, you're right.
You don't have to tell me when I'm right. I know when I'm right. Now, let's do it. Come on, this is just a miserable way to spend a Sunday.
Our first segment is called Father and Son Memories. We've each prepared a story. My story takes place at a Little League game when I was 13. A ground ball went through my legs, and Dad screamed, "Hey, fellas, anyone want to lend me their son for the day so I have something to cheer about?" Do you remember that, Dad?
I don't remember you ever playing baseball.
I played for 8 years.
Well, I remember you were on a team. I just don't remember you playing baseball. Ha, ha, ha.
Surprising I wasn't a better player. I mean, we practiced once, but then you left because you were worried my sissy was contagious.
Yeah. All right, I forgot. Everything's my fault, isn't it? Maybe I should blame my dad for not being a better parent, or blame his dad. Or go back to blame the caveman for not playing enough dinosaur ball with his kid. Or plan B, be responsible for yourself.
The scary thing is it's basically a campaign platform.
So who wrote that sketch and why was it a father and son sketch? And I'm thinking of all the jokes you've made about his relationship or his lack of relationship seemingly with Eric. So why was this a father-son sketch?
Well, I clocked pretty fast that that was the kind of guy he was. And, you know, you spend a couple days at SNL, or a day and a half, basically, before you have to start writing things. And I always found it was helpful to just sort of pay attention to the host and think, what could they believably do? And especially when they're not actors. You know, they don't come with a lot of different takes on things. And I thought, well, I bet he could play a father who was pretty not into his kid. And it wasn't bad. I will say, the other thing about that week that I remember was, and this is true, I'm not making this up, he carried around, he had cut out the ratings, the Nielsen ratings for that week. And he had them in his pocket. And I remember he would basically ask everybody a couple questions and then just show it to them. Like, for example, I remember sitting there rehearsing that. He would say, "Do you like this job?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And he goes, "How long have you been here?" I said, 3 years. And he said, "Did you see the ratings?" That is a real thing.
We're listening to Terry's interview with NBC Late Night host Seth Meyers. It was recorded earlier this year at an event celebrating the 30th anniversary of Fresh Air as a national radio program. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with NBC late night host Seth Meyers, conducted this past June in front of a live audience at Philadelphia's Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. It was part of our 30th anniversary celebration of Fresh Air on NPR.
Okay, we have one more Trump place to go.
Okay.
And this is the White House Correspondents' Dinner from 2011.
Thank you.
And this was a very famous evening because Seth Meyers and President Obama both roasted Donald Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner that year, and nobody at the dinner knew except President Obama that the next day was the day of the bin Laden strike, of the successful strike against Osama bin Laden. You certainly didn't know that.
You don't have
he
to.
Told you, didn't
you
he?
Don't have to
he
say it like that. Say, yeah.
So let's watch a couple of minutes of you at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Happily.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke. Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. If you're at the Washington Post table with Trump and you can't finish your entree, don't worry, the fox will eat it. And if I can for a moment talk about the birther issue, when did we get so suspicious about where people were born? A USA Today poll last week said 38% of Americans think the president was definitely born in the US. In the same poll, in the very same poll, only 5% more said Donald Trump was definitely born in the US. Has it reached the point where Americans only think someone was born here if they saw it? I know I was born here, and I know my younger brother was born here. But when it comes to my older brother, I can only take him at his word. Gary Busey said recently that Donald Trump would make a great president. Of course, he said the same thing about an old rusty birdcage he found. Donald Trump owns the Miss USA pageant, which is great for Republicans because it will streamline their search for a vice president. Donald Trump said recently he has a great relationship with the blacks, though unless the blacks are a family of white people, I bet he's mistaken.
As we could see in the video, there were cutaways to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
As you were saying that, he did not appear to be laughing.
No.
Some people say that the reason why he decided to make a serious run for president was because he was so offended by the jokes that you and President Obama told that night. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, it was funny. In the lead up to the election, there were some pieces that were written that said as much, and many of those pieces left me out of it and just talked about President Obama's jokes. And I was very confident at the time that Donald Trump was going to lose. And it hurt my feelings that I was left out of being one of the people that tricked this man into running for president. And then as soon as he won, I realized it was Obama's fault. But I don't know. I really don't know. It's very hard to get inside Donald Trump's brain, and I don't want to try. So I don't know the answer to that. But I will say I don't have any regrets about it or anything I did in the lead up to the election. I think the regrets I would have would be if I had done less, if I had pointed out less. And it was a really fun night.
So Lorne was like your boss on Saturday Night Live. He tapped you to host Late Night.
Yeah.
After Jimmy Fallon was tapped by him to host The Tonight Show. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised that he asked you?
I was. And actually, it was originally, I think in the New York Post, they printed Seth Meyers is rumored to be the replacement. And Lorne and I had never spoke of it. And I just took it to be a rumor. And then Lorne called me that day. And there's this thing with Lorne where often when you have a conversation with him, it's a follow-up conversation to a conversation that you never had. So he's acting like you've already talked about it. And so I just remember he called up and said, look, you'll be fine. I think it'll take some time, but you'll be good at it. And, you know, we'll miss you, but I think it's good. And I just remember thinking, wait a second. Did he just offer me late night? I had no idea what was happening. But sure enough, that was what had happened.
How has it changed your life?
I mean, it is strange because I do walk into the same building. It is on the same floor as Saturday Night Live. So there are parts of my life that are very similar, you know, that I did not have to move to a new place or a new, you know, elevator bank. But it is, there's this lovely consistency to a job that is the same hours every day and the same schedule every day. And also, you know, at SNL, they call the guests hosts for a reason, because they completely take over the DNA of that week. Whereas at your own show, you're the host because the guests ultimately don't change the show that much. And so, and as someone who is obviously every day older, it's nice to be in a place that is a little bit more consistent. That is the part I enjoy the most.
Your life has changed so much. You've gone from Saturday Night Live to hosting a daily show. And you had your baby about 14 months
yes.
ago, you and your wife?
Yeah, little boy.
So like you're a father and a relatively new host. It's been, what, 3 years?
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
And you're what, 42 now? You're 43. So you were about 42 when your son was born.
Yeah.
Did you expect to be a father?
I did. I always thought I'd be a father, and then I was just one way too interested in busy with what I was doing for a living, and two, you know, I hadn't found the right person to have him with. And
so,
I did.
Okay, so, yeah. Okay, this sounds like a strange question. Why did you want to be a father? Because not everybody does.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, I really don't. And the weirdest thing about being a father is how, because I think, you know, mothers, like, their body for 9 months tells them it's coming. And then you just, you aren't a dad, and then you just are.
Right.
Like the very next day. I was, this is a true story, I was filling out paperwork after our baby was born, and it said mother's name, and I wrote my wife's name, and then it said father's name, and I wrote my wife's father's name. And then it said father's phone number, and I thought, who knows their father-in-law's phone number? And then I realized, oh, I'm the father.
Okay, so one more question. You have to have a lot of adrenaline every night
yeah.
to do the show. And it's adrenaline's great when you need it, but it's bad as a chronic thing for your body. You know, bodies don't like to have constant adrenaline.
Yeah.
Lots of side effects of that. So what do you do?
I had no idea. This is heartbreaking to me. Yeah. So I'm sorry to end with this, but you are slowly dying.
So what do you do to kind of calm yourself down after getting, you know, worked up? Like, you know, like just getting so into it for the show.
You know, I basically...
Drugs, I know, right.
Just a
There's
little,
lots
yeah.
lots of drugs. Yeah.
Handful of pills.
Handful of
and,
pills.
And, no, I mean, you know, it's nice. I get home about 8:30. I get to have dinner with my wife, which, again, you know, we've been together, we were together through SNL as well, and there were, at SNL, we never saw each other. And this is so much nicer... And just to spend time with her is the perfect. I love it. I'm like, nothing kills adrenaline like a night with my wife. I mean, tell you, it just leaves the body.
Okay, well.
I love you, darling.
I want to thank you, Seth Meyers. I think you are so great. And I really enjoy your show. It's been wonderful to watch you over the years. You know, all the changes you've gone through. I feel like I've been there in front of my TV, seeing it. And you're so wonderful in person. Thank you so much. It's just been such an honor to have you.
Thank you.
Doing this event with us.
And may I say thank you all very much. So kind. There are... There were three moments in my career where I thought I had made it. The first time I did David Letterman, the first time I was an answer in a New York Times crossword puzzle, and the first time I did Fresh Air. And to do it with you live and in person is such a great honor. Every night when I interview people, I am thinking, I wish I could be as good at this as Terry Gross. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. God, thank you, Seth.
Really appreciate it.
Seth Meyers, host of NBC's Late Night, was interviewed by Terry Gross last June at Verizon Hall at Philadelphia's Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. Fresh Air celebrated its 30th anniversary as a daily program on NPR this year, and this event was part of that celebration. After a break, another of our favorite interviews of 2017, with Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj. He hosted the most recent White House Correspondents' Dinner, the one President Donald Trump did not attend. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. This week, we've been featuring some of our favorite interviews of 2017. One of them is Terry's interview with Hasan Minhaj, a correspondent on Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Minhaj was hired by Jon Stewart just a few months before Stewart left the show. The Trump administration has provided plenty of material for satire, but has also created serious concerns for the Minhaj family. His parents are Muslim immigrants from India. The night after the election, Hasan Minhaj talked about his fears that his mother, an American citizen who was visiting family in India, might be prevented from returning to the U.S. because of the Muslim ban proposed by President-elect Trump. Terry spoke with Minhaj in April 2017, shortly before his Netflix comedy special Homecoming King was released. It's about growing up in Davis, California, the son of immigrants. Here's a clip. It's the story of an anonymous threatening phone call his family received at home right after 9/11. Just after the phone call, the windows on the family car were shattered. Hasan went out into the street to see if he could find out who did it.
I look back in the middle of the street. My dad's in the middle of the road, sweeping glass out of the road like he works at like a hate crime barbershop. Just like, we got customers, we gotta clean this up. Zen, brown Mr. Miyagi, just like not saying a word. I run up to him like, Dad, why aren't you saying something? I'm not asking you, say something. He looks at me and he goes, Hassan, ye cheeze to hote hain? Or ye cheeze hoenge? These things happen, and these things will continue to happen. That's the price we pay for being here. And that's when I was like, oh no, we really are from two different generations. Like BMX bikes aside. Like my dad's from that generation, like a lot of immigrants, where he feels like if you come to this country, you pay this thing like the American dream tax, right? Like you're gonna endure some racism. And if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out, pay it. There you go, Uncle Sam. But for me, like a lot of us, I was born here. So I actually have the audacity of equality.
That's an excerpt of Homecoming King. Hassan Minhaj, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this new show.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Can you talk a little bit more about the difference in your point of view about what it means to be an immigrant and a Muslim in America now, and what the difference generationally between your father as an immigrant and you as somebody who was born here?
Yeah, the biggest difference between, and I feel like a lot of third culture kids feel this, and I identify as a third culture kid, meaning that, you know, my family's from Aligarh, India. They immigrated to America. I was born here. I exist in this hyphen. I'm an Indian American Muslim kid, but am I more Indian? Am I more American? What part of my identity am I? And one of the biggest things immigrant kids oftentimes feel is it's this big disparity between our parents and us. Our parents are staunch pragmatists, and we actually, I consider myself to be an optimist, you know. So when my dad immigrated here, we talk about it in the show, there's this thing called, you know, the American dream tax. You're going to come here, you're going to endure some struggles, some problems. But if you don't die, if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out. My dad is a child of partition when it happened in India. So if I explain the concept of microaggressions to him, he's like, I dealt with full-on aggression. You're lucky. Put your head down and go.
Partition is when Pakistan divided from India. And there was a lot on both sides of this new border. There was a lot of violence and a lot of death.
Yes, and it was one of the largest mass exoduses of people from India to Pakistan. My dad's family stayed in Aligarh in India, which was a huge decision because you're dividing a country based on religious lines. So the things that he saw and witnessed as a kid, he doesn't want to hear about my identity crises at school, you know, and how I want to just, you know, fall in love and fit in. For him, things that he witnessed during that generation and era were very, very extreme and oftentimes violent. But what's weird is, you know, for me as a kid growing up, going to school, taking honors gov in high school and learning about equality and civil liberties, you actually at a young age have this sense of optimism where you're like, oh, so I am equal. That means I shouldn't be treated this way. And that's where there's this big sort of differentiation between us and our parents. And, you know, that night, you know, when I tell that story of September 12th, it was the first night of so many nights where I kind of was put in this position where, do I think like my dad? You know, do I sweep up the glass that's in the road? Do I sort of just forget this hate crime? Do I sweep up the glass that way the neighbors don't see it and just go back inside and actually be grateful that they broke the windows on the car? They didn't break the windows to the house and try to, you know, come in and do something and just, hey, just count my blessings. Or do I use this as a moment to be like, no, this is wrong and I should speak up and say something? Because it's these moments where maybe my generation can move the needle forward a little bit and talk about this. But I even say it in the show, that pendulum swings back and forth for me all the time. I don't have a clear, you know, that this is the way you deal with this. There's sometimes where maybe my dad's right, and there's sometimes where I'm like, no, I think he's wrong. I think being an angry optimist is the solution.
So there are a lot of cultural differences between you and your father. And let's start with the fact that your father hadn't even met your mother when he decided to marry her. Can you describe the circumstances of their marriage?
My dad was doing grad school and he was in Aligarh. You know, he was of age to get married. And he had heard about this girl named Seema, my mom. And I talk about it in the show, the hype around Seema. She was like the iPhone 8 of Aligarh. People were just like, oh, my God, have you heard of this girl named Seema? she's very slim and slender, and her family owns a camera. And my dad was like, oh my God, a camera, I can't believe this. You know, so he just, off of just this Yelp review of who she was and what her family was like, he just ran down to my grandfather's house and laid it all on the line. He's just like, what's up? I'm Najmi. I'm a chemist. I'm going to America. Please let me marry Seema. And in 10 minutes, he married a woman he had never laid eyes on. And it's a pretty incredible story when I think about it, because that level of decisiveness is something that I don't have. I'm his son. I don't have that level of decisiveness. But because of that decision, I'm here. And it's pretty wild.
Okay, so he marries your mother without meeting her. You, yes. On the other hand, you were born in 1985. So you grew up with, like, yes. Hip-hop. You know, yeah. You grew up with television and movies, but the kind of television and movies where sex is a constant presence. And
right,
sex
right,
before
right.
marriage is a constant presence.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Again, like, the difference between, like, your father's cultural values growing up in India and your own growing up here are so much at odds with each other. Was it hard for you to, and obviously, like, you wanted to fit in when you were in high school. Was it hard for you to find a place where you could survive at home and be your father's son, but also be the person you wanted to be at school and with your friends?
Yeah. His rules with me growing up were very simple. No fun, no friends, no girlfriends. You can have fun in med school, which is just like a huge lie. I mean, Terry, that's just a blatant lie. It never, you know, you go to a club and you just see a bunch of dudes going crazy. Like, what's going on, fellas? Oh, what's going on? Residency. Like, I'm having the time of my life. It doesn't work like that. But I felt like for my dad, I am his first-round draft pick. You know, like, I'm the LeBron James to his franchise. I have to deliver the dream.
Let's talk about your mother. You know, we talked about how your father decided to marry your mother through kind of hearing about her through word of mouth and seeing a picture. So they got married. They moved to the States. But she went right back to India soon after because she was studying medicine and wanted to complete med school there. So basically for the first 8 years of your life, you were brought up by your father with occasional visits from your mother.
Yes.
Yeah. So when your mother returned for good to your home and the family was reunited, the family suddenly got much larger because your mother brought with her a 5-year-old girl who you were told was your sister, the sister you'd never met because your mother and father conceived your sister in India during one of his visits to India to visit your mother. So you were kind of stunned when you found out that you had this sister that nobody ever told you about. Why didn't they tell you?
I think it's one of those things where, okay, this is an important piece of information, but obviously, you know, it's finessed for the one-man show format. My younger sister, Aisha, was born in the States. And then at 2 months after her birth, she went to go live with my grandparents and be raised there. So I didn't officially, you know, get a chance to really meet her until I was 8. My grandparents were in India. And it was set up in such a way that way she could be raised. And she was around cousins. And it was an amazing way for her to grow up. Our narratives are very different. She grew up in India, like literally it took a village. She was around people that loved her and were there for her. And I was this brown kid who was alone in America with his dad. And so when she came back, I was just like, I hate this person. Like, who are you? I just want a mom. Now I got you.
So I'm going to stop you here because we have a clip from your show Homecoming King in which you talk about how you felt about your sister as this kind of like intruder in your life when she came to live with you. So let's hear that clip. And this is Hasan Minhaj from his new Netflix comedy special, Homecoming King.
I hated that brown girl so much. Can I be honest with you guys? I totally understood the wall. I was like, build that wall. I was like a little Republican. I get it. I remember leveling with my parents at the dinner table. I was like, look, mom, dad, let's just be real. Oh my God, these brown people, oh geez. Coming into our house, eating our fruit roll-ups. They don't speak the language. I say we tell them to go back to where they came from. That's just me. He's like, Hasan, you can't say that. We're family. We're all that we have. I'm like, nah, that's on you and mom. Like, you guys decided to get your Angelina Jolie on and bring over this fob in a frock. That's on you. That's not on me.
Okay, that's Hasan Minhaj from his new one-man show. So you describe in your show that you took all the anger channeled at you, all the anger channeled at you because you're brown and Muslim, and you channeled it at your new sister. How did you realize that you were doing that?
I didn't realize how messed up it was until there was this incident where, you know, I wanted to be treated special in a certain way. And then when my sister got there, my dad took a lot of that guilt and not being able to be there the first several years of her life, missing her first steps, her first words, all of those things. And he got her this gift that I always wanted, this blue BMX bike that I had wanted. It was in the Toys R Us Kids catalog, and I had this cutout on my wall. And then for her fifth birthday, he brings everybody in the living room, and he gives her this bike. And I stole that bike from her, and I took it around the block, even though she lent it to me. She's like, you can take it out for the first ride. And I took it, and I popped a wheelie, and I actually fell off the bike, and I messed up the bike. It, like, fell over, and all the blue paint got, like, chipped off the side of the bike. And I remember her running over and just crying, bawling. And I remember looking down at her and being like, wow, like, this is really messed up. I resent this girl. I hate her. She's like my foil. But I've been looking for acceptance from everyone at school, and she's just wanted to hang out with. That's all she wants. She just wants to be around me. She wants me to teach her about America and teach her English, and she just wants to be my best friend. What am I doing? And it was sort of this moment where I remember finally kind of realizing, it was the first time where I realized maybe family and looking out for one another is an important thing. Like, it's right here underneath my nose, and I should value it.
We're listening to an interview with Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj. Terry interviewed him in April. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Joyce Foundation, working to promote the vitality of communities, improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region, and achieve a more just society. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from Burlington Stores, committed to helping communities. Since 2007, they've donated 1.8 million coats. Through January 22nd, Burlington is collecting gently worn coats so people can stay warm. BurlingtonStores.com.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj. He spoke with her in April, shortly after hosting this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner. His Netflix comedy special, Homecoming King, is about growing up the son of Muslim immigrants from India.
So you tell a story in your show about how you were about to perform at the Comedy Store in New York when your sister calls you that your father is about to have a quintuple bypass after having did he have a heart attack before that?
A heart attack, yeah. He had a heart attack.
So
it was the Comedy Store in L.A.
Oh, in L.A. Okay, yeah, so you're closer to his home than I thought.
I'm closer to home. Yeah, I'm living in Los Angeles at the time. I get a call from my sister, Hasan Bhai, come home. Dad had a heart attack. You need to come home now.
Right, because your family was living in Davis, California.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you do your show at the Comedy Store, then you go to be with your father. So what was the calculus you did in your mind to decide whether you should cancel your show and just leave or do the show first and then go? That strikes me as a really hard choice that you made.
Yeah.
One I'm not sure you were happy with.
But yeah, I'm not. I'm still not happy with it. Sorry, it's just like, it was a very ugly thing. I love my dad a lot, you know, and it's something I'm not very proud of, but I was very, very angry at that time. I was living in LA and I'm pursuing comedy on my own terms. My parents specifically my dad wasn't very, you know, supportive of it. And I remember when I got the call to go home, my sister was really worried. And I was just thinking, yeah, I got to do this set. And in my head, it was basically just like, you know, this is my time now. Nobody can tell me what to do. No one's going to control whether I can leave the house or not. He doesn't get it, but I'll come home after the set. And I'm very embarrassed that I made that choice. It was just
Don't you think in a way sometimes that the tighter a parent's grip is, the more like you have to just like double down when you're breaking away and like demand like, no, I'm drawing the line. You know, and
but
you
just
sometimes
in the face
do
of a
like,
heart attack. I mean,
no, I know. And you sometimes do things that you're not proud of as a result. But I do think that is a phenomenon. Do you know what I mean? That when a parent holds on tight, it's so hard to kind of break away and become the person you want to be that you sometimes do some really, like stupid, even dangerous things.
It was just a kind of ugly thing, you know, because I knew better. But in that moment, it's just, I was feeling that grip for so many years that you finally sort of feel free. And you just want to be your own person and make your own choices in spite of that. And I decided to do a set, and I've done thousands of sets, but that night I decided to do that set because it was almost just like defiant in a weird, in a strange way to be like, no, I'm going to come home on my own terms. And you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And
but you talk about when you did come home and you saw your father, and you said goodbye to him before the surgery, before the bypass, and you thought, if he dies, like if something happens to him, I will never have really gotten to know him.
Yeah.
And you talk about how you decided then that you'd better really get to know him as a person better, and it sounds like you did. What did you do to be able to do that? Because as somebody who you've described as keeping secrets and not being forthcoming with you, how did you change the terms of your relationship?
I was forced to. I don't think it was as much of an act of bravery and courage as it was he had to sit and recover in the hospital. I'm a full-time stand-up comedian. My sister and my mom actually have real jobs. So I'm just forced to sit and talk to him in this hospital room, and you run out of stories. There's only so much Wheel of Fortune you can watch. And so I started telling him stories about my life, and he started telling me stories about his life, because we just were together all day for weeks. So I was able to start to piecemeal things about his life, and he started to hear stories from my life. And that's how we were able to sort of bridge that divide. And I realized a lot of the things that he was keeping secret, he just didn't want me to worry about, you know? He
like
just
what?
Was like, I mean, things like, why didn't you ever tell me how you met Mom? Or why didn't you guys tell me more about the Aisha stuff? Logistically, why didn't you just talk to me about it? And, you know, my dad was actually really honest. He was like, I could tell when I would look at you, you were having a tough time at school. You were having a tough time fitting in. If we dangle that over your head, you know, you actually have a sibling. You actually have a sidekick who looks like you, who has the same skin color as you, who you could share a lot of these experiences with. Oh, but she's in India. It would break your heart to have that reminder be dangled over your head. You know, they're just like, I kept that information from you so that maybe you'd be safe or things would be easier. The thing that I kind of told him, and, you know, he said the same thing about me. Why would you keep all these things from me? I had the same reasoning with him and Mom. I didn't tell them about sneaking out of the house or falling in love or kissing a girl or trying to go to prom, all of those things, because I didn't want them to worry. But everybody's worrying about what other people will think. The truth is still the truth, and it's the most powerful thing you can share with the person that you love. So it wasn't until, you know, my dad and my family seeing death that we had to be like, all right, we got to be on the same page and we got to talk about this stuff. It's one of those things where it's a reminder of, you know, your parents' mortality.
Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj speaking to Terry Gross in April. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj. His Netflix comedy special, Homecoming King, is about growing up the son of Muslim immigrants from India.
There's a moment in your show that I really love. And I don't know. There's a lot of moments I really love, but I'm going to mention this one. You talk about how you auditioned for The Daily Show and how you got job and everything.
Right.
And then you say to Jon Stewart, John, my dad knows you. And I love that because your father probably had no frame of reference for any of the comedy you were doing or for any of your comedy
heroes.
Nothing. Yeah. But I guess he knew The Daily Show?
Yeah. The Daily Show oddly became the current equivalent of journalism. He actually would see clips of it, and he held John in the same esteem that he would hold, you know, Dan Rather. So to him, he was like, oh, this is a guy who's actually doing something good for society. And I would, you know, sometimes tell him, you know, Dad, you know, John is a stand-up comedian. He's like, no. This guy, he's a news anchor. He's just funny. I mean, he doesn't tell jokes to drunk people at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's what you do. This guy's not a clown. He's a real, you know, the real deal. And so when I had that moment when I got the job, I wanted to share that Oscar speech with John, but all I could say was like, my dad knows you. And he's like, all right, I'm sure he does. All right, man, I'll see you later. Like, John doesn't understand the magnitude of what that meant. But for me, it was a huge deal. I had been doing stand-up 10 years, 1 month, and 9 days. And to finally have something where your parents know what it is, it meant everything to me.
After the election, you did a piece on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And it ended with you talking about how your mother, at that moment, was in India visiting family, and she called you and said to you, do you think it's safe for me to come home? You know, do you think I'll be able to come home back to America? And you said,
yeah.
I don't know. It sounds like it was a horrible, frightening moment for you. What was the outcome of that?
We got her home ASAP because I didn't know. We were doing a live show that night. It was our election night special. We had a script written that was, you know, it followed what we thought was going to happen, that Hillary Clinton would be president. As the results were coming in, we're literally tearing apart our script. We're rewriting a one-hour live show in real time. And I'm on WhatsApp audio with my mom. My mom being like, we're watching the news. I'm with your grandma. What's going on? And so I'm trying to write jokes about Trump winning the election while I'm on kayak.com, like looking up tickets for her to come back. I'm also looking up like, what's the legal recourse? How does it work? All of a sudden I have to become an immigration attorney, a son, and a comedian all in one. It was a horrible 48 hours. It was the worst. And not knowing that everything will be okay was just really awful. It was really, really awful.
But you managed to get her home.
We did. we managed to get her home before the Muslim ban happened, too. I didn't want to risk anything. Like, mm-hmm. we got her home. She was supposed to be there for several months, and we just got her home ASAP.
Hasan Minhaj, it's been really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Terry. I appreciate it.
Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj speaking to Terry Gross this past April. Like the other conversations we've replayed this holiday week, it's one of our favorite interviews of 2017. On Monday's show, we conclude our holiday series featuring some of our favorite interviews from 2017 with Jonathan Groff. He stars in the Netflix series Mindhunter, played King George in Hamilton, was the voice of the Iceman and his reindeer in the film Frozen, and starred in the musical Spring Awakening and the HBO series Looking about a group of gay friends. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuri. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a healthy and happy New Year.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans for the Arts, dedicated to advancing an arts industry that employs 4.8 million people in towns and cities across the country. Learn more at americansforthearts.org. And from the Epstein Family Foundation, in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiullah Tamana Memorial Fund, established to support NPR's international journalists, their coverage, and their commitment to providing the news of the world to audiences back home.